This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Isn't it equal?
From WDET in Detroit, this is Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson. Dr. Mona Hanna Attisha is a pediatrician, a scientist, an activist, and an author who was largely responsible for advocacy for Flint's children during the water crisis in that city. Luke Schaefer is a professor of social justice and social policy and the director of poverty solutions at the University of Michigan. Together, Dr. Mona and Dr. Luke are the brains behind RX Kids, a program in Flint that will move cash assistance to pregnant mothers, $1,500 while they're pregnant, and then $500 a month during the first year of their child's life. I'm here with Carrie Jr. II, our producer on Created Equal. It's a really great and bold idea, Carrie. I wonder how it will work.
Yeah, I'm curious why they chose to do these payments for everyone and not to target a population. Because to me, we've always been having the debate about equality versus equity. This is like, we're going to give out everything regardless of circumstances. Will it really help the folks who need it the most? I don't know.
I think the approach is, and this is the same thing that is behind the thinking for things like universal free breakfast in schools, right? So like right now the state is saying, instead of picking the kids who we think need free breakfast because they're not being fed at home consistently, let's just offer it to everybody.
But isn't that equality and not equity?
Actually, that is equity, right? Equity is that everyone is getting access to something.
That's not how I understood it.
What?
I thought equity was you provide what's necessary for the folks who are behind to get in the same place as someone who started from, you know, net zero.
Right. Well, that's one way to think about it. But in this case, the equity approach here is to offer it to everybody to make sure that whatever the need is, wherever the need is, it's getting met. And even if that need is among people who technically shouldn't need it, mm-hmm. they still might, right? They still might. There's all kinds of circumstances that could lead people who wouldn't qualify under an economic trigger mm-hmm. to get the free breakfast.
It sounds like the framing is less on let's catch up one group that's behind to the group that's starting at next zero and more about let's just make sure there's enough out there so that we definitely catch the people who are behind.
That's right.
I see. It's not trying to alleviate all of the issues, but
right.
it's trying to just say, let's start a new life here.
If we eliminate these problems, just this set of really acute problems, people who are not eating while they're pregnant, people who never go see a doctor mm-hmm. while they're pregnant, people who never take a baby back to the doctor after it's born in a hospital. I mean, these are problems that if you do that, you are casting forward mm-hmm. a series of circumstances and issues that you will never recover from, right? You cannot fix that. If that gets broken at that point, you are setting your kid up for, a life of deficiency. I think what they're saying is we don't have to do that. We can start in the same place that with everybody getting at least the bare minimum of what they need to have a shot.
What question are you asking of them? Are we asking them?
I think what we want to know is how did you come up with this, right?
Right.
How did you decide this is the point to intervene?
Has this been tried before in some iteration?
Has this been tried somewhere else,
yeah.
right? Do we know that this will produce certain outcomes? It's a fascinating concept again, and it's getting a lot of support. I can't wait to ask them where they came up with this idea and how they sustain it. Dr. Mona Hanna Attisha and Dr. Luke Schaefer, welcome to Created Equal.
It is so wonderful to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you both here in the studio as
well.
So let's start off with just the facts, right? What is RX Kids and where did this idea come from?
That's a great question. RX Kids is this first ever program to literally eliminate infant poverty in Flint, Michigan. It is a citywide maternal and infant cash prescription program. We are giving every pregnant mama in Flint unrestricted cash and every baby cash.
And eliminate child poverty. I mean, that's an extreme interpretation of what you're doing. Is that a realistic goal? Eliminate child poverty.
Well, what we know is that this is the first time we've ever done this in the United States for a city, but it builds on this incredible evidence base from all over the world of child allowances and child benefits that, you know, every time a country adopts a program that says, hey, raising kids is expensive, and society has a reason to come alongside families in that work, and they provide some money to help families buy food or cribs or books for their kids, that you see child poverty plummet. You see food hardship plummet, and kids and families do better in so many ways. And we did it here in the United States with the expanded child tax credit for a year.
Which we saw lower child poverty
to lowest.
Unbelievable numbers that we hadn't seen before. Right?
Millions and millions of kids lifted out of poverty. So it builds on this evidence, but it takes it to the next level, I would say. It's building momentum and focusing on this first year of life, which, as I've been hanging out with Mona, I've learned is like so incredibly critical to the development of the life course.
Yeah. Let's talk about the practical end of this. So you say cash assistance to every pregnant mother in Flint. What does that look like? How much is it? And what are some of the other things you're also trying to make sure they have access to?
Yeah, so folks can sign up online at flintrxkids.com. It's a very simple, easy application. We're working with an international leader in doing this work. It's an international organization called Give Directly. They have perfected how to get people money. So moms enroll online. It takes about 10 minutes. The application has actually been mama tested. So our moms who have been part of this process from the beginning have made sure it works and it's easy, and they can it's easy to answer the questions. They upload verification of residency. So this is only for City of Flint folks. And they also upload verification of pregnancy or if they have an infant. And then our Give Directly partners verify that data and get in and then approve folks. And then cash is transferred either directly to a checking account or they get a prepaid debit card. So it launched in January and it's been pretty seamless of a process.
Yeah. And you hope that with that cash, what they do is support themselves and the kid who's coming, the child who's coming into the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, based on global and domestic evidence, we know what people use when they have cash support. They spend that money on food and rent and utilities and enrichment for their children.
Yeah. So I want to talk a little about the context in which this is taking place. Of course, it's in the city of Flint. Mona, you and I have been talking for many years now about what happened there. And not just about the event, which was, you know, switching the water supply to a source that wasn't cleaned properly and exposed everybody in the city to lead poisoning. But the fact that it was done in a city that already had all of these challenges, where the population had been deprived of so many resources for so long that it had an outsized effect, that it was worse than what it could have been. Why is this approach that you're taking with RX Kids important in a city like Flint?
Yeah, Stephen, you and I love history. And, you know, the understanding of the history of Flint really kind of helps us really get to this point where we are launching this bold, impossible idea, because that's also what Flint is known for. So one of my favorite pictures is from the Flint sit-down strikes.
Yes.
So in the 1930s, auto workers in Flint did something totally crazy, totally disobedient and illegal. And they sat down and they occupied the car plants for 44 days, demanding recognition, demanding better pay, occupational health and safety and pensions and living wages, you know, things that we're still fighting for today. And there's this amazing picture of Flint children in the 1930s protesting alongside, you know, their parents. And there's a kid that's holding up a sign saying, what is it? It's like, we deserve a chance at better food and a better life.
Wow.
I think I messed it up the words a little bit, but I think it's close to that.
Better food and better life.
Yeah. Give us a chance at better food and a better life.
This is in the 30s.
Yeah. And, the history that followed is that Flint was this place of prosperity, where per capita income was the highest in the nation, a promised land for immigrants, for African Americans in the Great Migration North. People came to Flint for great jobs and living wages and benefits and good education and great infrastructure. And then the history that followed, in many of our post-industrial cities, was of kind of, rampant capitalism and greed and exploitation and racism and white flight that left Flint starving and bankrupt and in crisis for decades, which set up the scenario for the water crisis. But that same history of fighting for a chance at better food and a better life is what drives the boldness of this program, because we are continuing to fight for that for our children, and ARX Kids is an actualization of that promise.
Yeah. Wow. That's incredible the way that history is kind of informing the way you're thinking about that. Of course, that history also produced the labor union.
Yes, the UAW was born.
The UAW gets born out of that, and that creates the idea of a massive middle class, people
absolutely
who can work in auto plants and earn money to buy houses and buy cars that they're making and all of these other things. Yeah. Luke, this is aimed at the first year of life. Talk about what that looks like. What happens in that first year that will make a difference?
Well, the first thing that we learned as we moved along, we came in knowing that this first year of life and even those months right before a baby is born are incredibly consequential for the life trajectories of people.
I've given Luke an honorary pediatric degree. He's really gotten the pediatrics. He's like a real doctor too now.
Doctor. You said that, not me.
No, I have to tell my children who always say, you're not a real doctor. But babies' brains double in size. So much of how they view the world is being shaped. And we just want to spend that whole year loving on them, making sure that they're getting everything that they need, that they're playing with things, that they're in a safe house, that they're getting the food that they need. And unfortunately, it turns out that poverty spikes during that first year, like the highest it is on average across the entire life course. Income starts to go down in those last few months before childbirth as moms have to work less or are working less, and then stays low through the first year at the same time that you have all these new expenses. Yeah. You need cribs. You need car seats.
Childcare is so expensive.
Childcare.
Parental leave policies are not there.
Exactly. So it is like this perfect storm of poverty right when kids need the most and that we want to be just loving on them and caring for them the most. And we see this in other outcomes too. So child welfare is another one with out-of-home foster care placements. They actually spike to the very highest across childhood in that first year as well.
Is that right? Wow.
So much going on in that first year, and we do so little to support families during that time. And so this is an evidence-based, strategic way to invest in families and also change the way that we invest in families. It's a very different kind of program than what so many people are used to.
Yeah. Mona, you're a doctor, a pediatrician.
A real doctor.
You said that, not me. And you see these kids in that first year, and you see not only the needs that they have, but the needs that aren't being met. And I wonder if you think that by extending this kind of cash assistance, you will see more kids engage in the medical system, in well visits and things like that in that first year. Like, are there attendant other changes that you think this cash assistance will affect?
Absolutely. For, you know, I'm still a practicing pediatrician. I was in clinic this week, snuggling and caring for our little ones. And I have so often wished for the ability to prescribe an antidote to poverty. So much of what I see in clinic is a consequence of our failure to invest in the foundation of children and their families. We had a four-day-old in clinic the other day who missed their first appointment. It was a baby born early. It was 5 pounds. Mom couldn't make that appointment. And when we called to find out why, mom had to go back to work at 4 days of age.
Wow.
Can you imagine, like at 4 days of age, 4 days after giving birth, having to go back to work? And that just makes me angry because as a nation, as a society, we need to be walking alongside our families. So we see the consequence in missed visits. We see it in food insecurity and housing insecurity, and all of these what we call social determinants of health that impact the life course of children.
And you feel like the cash will disrupt that.
Absolutely, especially laser targeted in this window. I wish we could do this for all of childhood, mm-hmm. like so many other countries do. Child benefits are normal. Our south of us in Canada, they have child benefits. You know, the rest of the world in Western industrialized countries, but also in the global south, do child benefits. I wish we could extend it for longer, part of childhood. But if we were to pick a critical window, it is this maternal infant window that we hope to make a dent to impact things like maternal morbidity and maternal mortality, infant mortality, prematurity, low birth weight, breastfeeding, well child visits. There's so much in the health field that we hope to impact with this.
And those are all things that we see in Flint and Detroit.
And there's massive disparities. Yeah. There's massive kind of racial and geographic disparities. When you talk to kind of maternal health researchers who are doing all these wonderful interventions, we tell them about ARCS Kids, they're like, yes, this is the answer. Like, this is exactly what we should be doing. Moms don't need to go to 5 more classes to tell them what they're doing wrong. They need, they need the basic resources to help kind of take care of themselves and take care of their children.
Yeah, go ahead, Luke.
There's a couple of reasons why we think cash can be a more effective and a more efficient way to help families. And the biggest one is that families' lives are complicated. Mm-hmm. Sometimes families have housing and they don't have any food. And other times they have access to food but no housing. Sometimes they have transportation. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes they have somebody who can watch their kiddos, and sometimes they need childcare. And so we just don't know. Like, families know what they need best. And so cash basically takes the libertarian view of saying, we are going to trust families that they know best, and we're going to provide cash. And then families can use it for exactly what they need, and it becomes more effective than when we offer something other than cash that that many might need, but many might not. And so it doesn't serve them as well. And then there's also an efficiency argument, too, that it's simpler to provide cash.
Right.
It's still complicated, but it's something government can do well. So if you really believe in small, efficient government, this is the best way to help families.
Yeah, yeah. That's a great lead-in for what I want to talk about in the next segment, which is the universality of this program and this approach that says, we're not going to try to pick and choose. We're going to give it to everybody. I want to talk about where that thinking comes from and challenge you a bit on whether that is actually the best way to do this. So we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll continue this conversation with Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha and Dr. Luke Schaefer. They are the two folks behind RX Kids, which is giving cash assistance to every mother who's having a baby in the city of Flint. We'll be right back with more. Or created equal. Welcome back to Created Equal from 101.9 WDET in Detroit. I'm your host, Stephen Henderson, and today we're talking about a new program in the city of Flint, which was the site of a really tragic water crisis about a decade ago. But this new program is aimed at moving cash assistance to every mother who is having a child in the city of Flint as a way of offsetting the effects of poverty in that city. Of course, the water crisis exacerbated all kinds of other problems that Flint has had for a really long time. RX Kids is focused on interrupting that cycle, interrupting it at the point where it could make the most difference when children are actually born. With us is Dr. Mona Hanna Atisha, who was the physician in Flint who really first identified the problems that the city was having with the water crisis, the lead poisoning that was taking place citywide. Also with us is Dr. Luke Schaefer. He is the head of an organization called Poverty Solutions at the University of Michigan. They are partners in RX Kids. So we were talking about how this works and how the money will move to these families and what you expect it to do. I want to talk about a really specific part of this program, though, which is the idea that it's universal, right? You are not means testing this. You are not looking at different parts of the city and saying, well, this is a place where we really need this and we don't need it over here. Everybody in Flint is eligible. Every mother is eligible for this. And, we're having an argument about that approach right now in the state with regard to something the governor is trying to do. She says that the free breakfast program that we have in schools, which is means tested generally, should only be, she says it should be available to everyone as well. And there are people who are cheering that, but there are other people who are saying, that's a waste. You are giving this away to people who don't need it. And we could use those resources in a different way for those who do need it. I want to have you guys talk about the concept behind universality and why it's what you chose for this program.
Yeah, I think there's a couple reasons why we wanted this to be universal. And I think for me, the most important reason is that this is fundamentally how we should be caring for each other. Everyone is struggling during this period of childbirth and infancy. And this is a—
regardless of whether you're rich or poor.
Everybody is struggling. It is hard. You talk to folks in the middle class. You talk to folks, you know, like, yeah, it's hard. You know, I needed to do this and this. And childcare was like another mortgage, you know, paying for childcare. So everybody is struggling. And this is a strong message of saying, here we are, recognizing you, seeing and hearing how hard it is. And we are walking alongside you. And this is what other countries do. This is a universal benefit in so many other countries. So that's kind of the message that we want to send with the universality of it. But when you do put any means testing to anything, it makes it a more complicated program. It makes it a more expensive program.
Why?
Because you have to determine who's in and who's out. And then when you determine who's in and who's out, there's a line that is put in the sand, and then there's animosity. Why did that person get in, and why did that I not get in? Because I'm struggling too. So it's administratively more complicated to have any means testing. And it goes against this message once again that this is how we should be caring for children. And I'm sure Luke has some other important things to share.
Yeah, when you look at the history of our safety net, we have historically taken the approach of saying, you know, who's above the line, who's below the line, and those programs create exactly the kind of animosity that Mona's mentioning, where somebody, you know, maybe not somebody way way at the top, but somebody who's, you know, struggling to make ends meet, well above poverty, but still trying to figure out how to pay for childcare, diapers, says, hey, you know, I'm playing by the rules. Why am I not getting this? And it creates divisions between people. And then the other piece is that it has the impact of stigmatizing people below the line. So if you're asking a lot of different questions, and if you're really focused on making sure people who get the aid really deserve it, then those questions can actually pile up very quickly. And Michigan had this, interesting example where we had like the longest public benefits application in the country. There were all these incredibly intrusive questions that got added. It was super complicated. There was a question about, saying the date of the conception of your child, right? What, like, these things are incredibly personal, and they send all of these messages. So there's a really interesting study done by some colleagues of mine on nurse home visits. So we think nurse home visits can be really helpful to families, but they have very low take up a lot of the time. People
won't sign
aren't
up
interested,
for it.
Yeah, or don't sign up. And there was a community that actually made that program universal. So it had been something that had only been offered to low income families, and they said, we're going to make it universal and offer it to everyone, and then we'll figure out how to pay for it. Some of it's going to be government funds. Some of it's going to be philanthropic funds. And the biggest impact was that families who had already been eligible before took it up more. They were more willing to do it. In part, maybe it seemed less complicated. And then the second piece was maybe it seemed like we were sending a very different message. Yeah. So that all feeds into what Mona's talking about of like it just it's a very different thing to say, we're giving you this money because you can't handle this your business, you're poor, versus we're giving you this money because you're doing the most one of the most important things, if not the most important thing for society, which is raising your kids.
Investment in our
big philosophical difference, though, right? That you're talking about there.
Absolutely. And it plays into the argument about school lunches and what does it mean to have like separate lines? What does it mean to interrogate families about whether or not they're eligible? In Flint and in lower income cities, we have the benefit of, you know, everybody is, we have this extremely high poverty rate. But there is a very strong argument to be made that actually saying by serving everyone, I do better by the kids who need it the most.
It helps everybody. UNICEF has a recent report that also advocates for universal global child benefits. And the international evidence also shows that you have to at least include the middle class so that, you know, there would be enough support for these kind of programs.
Yeah. And in a way, this is also about trusting mothers and families to determine what's best for them and what they need, as opposed to having government decide what people need. And I guess I'm always surprised that that doesn't play more with conservatives. That's what they are supposedly believe, is that we should be making these decisions for ourselves. Now, I know this is, a subsidy of sorts, and that brings in other dynamics. But there is something to this idea that the people who are having these children know best about what they're doing.
Yeah, it is about freedom and choice for moms. And I think that's why libertarians are very supportive of unconditional cash transfers. I'm going to read you a quote from the 1920s when the child benefits were first introduced in the UK. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of debate about, like, should we tell folks what to spend their money on or should we just give them the money and they know best? And there was an amazing woman named Eleanor Rathbone who kind of led the movement for family allowances and then child benefits in the UK. And she said, "We are convinced that the money so dispersed would be spent both wisely and economically, since it is our view the mothers themselves are best able, because of their experience and training and their overwhelming personal interest, to apportion this expenditure in the way most calculated to secure the well-being of their children. No public authority can, in our view, make money go as far in the provision of food, clothing, and healthy surroundings as can the mothers who have learned economy in the hard school of experience."
Wow. Wow. That's from the 20s.
19th right. century. More than a century ago.
Right.
More than a century ago.
No new thing under the sun.
Yeah.
I'll just say, too, with the expanded child tax credit, we had tons of studies that asked, you know, using tons of different data, what did families spend the money on? And there was no impact on alcohol or tobacco spending. Families spent it on food. They spent it on rent. They spent it on books and toys for kids. Really, by providing that trust, too, I think families really take it seriously. And we can see that in the data.
But that's kind of counterintuitive to some of the narrative around poverty and how poor people make decisions, right? There's a lot in our culture that says these are people who got the way they are through negligence or on purpose and couldn't get themselves out if they were even given the resources. I mean, you're really doubling down on pushing back against that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is an interesting question. I have a new book out called The Injustice of Place, and a lot of it delves into the history of very, very poor places in the United States. And just like Mona read a quote from the 1920s, I could read you quotes and have them in my book from the 1800s about how the poor are just living off, you know, government support, and they don't work hard enough, and they don't use their resources wisely. Back when we had, like, no safety net, you know, there was, like, nothing around. And So these ideas are very deep and entrenched, and there might be an example when you provide cash, an example of somebody not using it wisely. But in the aggregate, time and time again, we see this is a way to like meet families' needs exactly where they are. Mm-hmm. Families spend it wisely. My favorite factoid about the child tax credit, besides reducing food hardship to the lowest level ever, reducing child poverty, increasing financial security, according to the Federal Reserve, was the number of Americans with bad credit actually hit an all-time historic low at the end of 2021 after we provided families money because they used it to like shore up their debt.
Yeah,
Stephen, we're very deliberate in working to change that narrative because that narrative is a myth, and a lot of this work that we are doing is working to rebuild trust and dignity and agency and empowerment and really celebrate our moms and our families who are working so hard to raise their children. They love their kids just as much as you and I love their kids.
And you're not saying that just as a believer in that philosophy. I mean, you're saying that as somebody who is treating the children who come from these families and
absolutely
in these circumstances every day. And
absolutely.
So do you see that?
Yeah, I see the moms working two jobs with a newborn, but still trying to make their appointments and do everything that they can to raise their children, but do not have the resources to be able to do it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the other thing I feel like the universality gets at is the fluidity of poverty and economic circumstances, which I think is increasing, right? And maybe it's the pandemic. There are some other things that have changed in the economy over the last decade or so. But the number of people who find themselves in really awful economic circumstances suddenly, even after years of living stably, is going up. And so if you try to means test something like this, you'd have to do it like every week because the pool of people
exactly
who qualify
right
is changing all the time.
Yeah, there's a great book out by some economists at NYU and that finds that the financial lives of poor families, we think of these as like static categories. You're in poverty, you're in the working poor, and as you say, actually the norm is huge swings from well above poverty, and it's really a matter of when you find families and where they are. And so that creates a lot of challenges because so much of our safety net is means tested. And so families will just be getting a foothold. They'll be working, and then suddenly their food benefits will be cut off, and they can go into, you know, a crisis that way. Medicaid insurance, you know, health insurance, and families are really worried about those. So that's another part of the way ARCS Kids is designed, is to say $1,500 in pregnancy, $500 a month until your baby turns one. This is one thing in all of this instability that you can count on from month to month that can provide that stability. You go to work, you don't go to work. This is what you can really build other things around. And that stability just is so much different from how the labor market works, how most of our public benefits work, and we hope will help stabilize families.
Yeah. Okay, when we come back, I want to talk a little more about money, the support for this. I want to talk about outcomes, how we know this is working, when we'll know this working, and how we build on all of this. How do we export this to other cities or add other services to it? Stay where you are. We'll be right back with more Create and Equal. Welcome back to Created Equal from 101.9 WDET in Detroit. I'm your host, Stephen Henderson, and I'm glad you've joined. We're talking about a new program in Flint, Michigan called RX Kids, which is going to move cash assistance to every pregnant mother in that city before they have their children and for the first year after their child is born. It is a way to disrupt the poverty that has kind of defined so much in Flint for for so long. The architects of the program are Mona Hannah Atisha, who is a pediatrician in Flint, and the person who really discovered first the water crisis that happened in that city that exposed everybody there to lead poisoning. Also with us is Luke Schaefer. He is the head of an organization called Poverty Solutions at the University of Michigan. Guys, I want to talk about the money for this. This is not a cheap thing to do. You've had some really generous support line up for it. I want to talk about where that money's coming from and why it's important, why the sources of that money are important and what it tells us about anti-poverty efforts in Michigan.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, one of the reasons this has not been done before, because it's expensive to do this for the entire city, is $9 million a year just in the cash prescriptions, not even in the operations or the research.
Wow.
So we set out to raise $55 million so that we could do this for at least 5 years of moms and babies. We have raised $43 million in about a year, which is amazing.
That's a lot.
It's a lot. It's amazing. And foundations and all kinds of folks are joyful, and they are championing this because a light bulb goes off. Like, like, we are spending so much money on things like nutrition insecurity and mental health services, where we could spend something at this kind of foundational, you know, early time. Mm. So the Mott Foundation, which is based in Flint, came in early with a $15 million challenge grant. They said, you have to raise another $15 million,
and
then you can unlock this.
Right.
So that made Luke and I really busy. And we, lots of other foundations came in, local ones like the Ruth Mott Foundation and our community foundation, state foundations like the Michigan Health Endowment Fund, national foundations like Kellogg and the Doris Duke Foundation. So lots of philanthropy has come in. We also were able to leverage ARPA dollars from the city of Flint. So these are the federal dollars that were part of the COVID relief public health recovery dollars. So it was wonderful to have that kind of federal investment as well from ARPA dollars. But I think the most exciting part of our blend of funding has been from the state, from the
state government.
Yeah. In the budget that passed last year, we received $16.5 million as a TANF redirection. And I'm going to pivot to Luke, who is a TANF expert, to explain why that is so exciting.
First, explain what TANF is, just briefly, for listeners who might not know.
TANF is short for Temporary Assistance for Needy Families,
right.
And it came out of the 1996 welfare law that some folks might be familiar. Bill Clinton came in to office promising to end welfare as we know it, and he did.
He did.
We thought it was a work-first program that would provide cash assistance to families, but also require work and have time limits on it. And maybe for a couple of years, that's essentially what it was. But it turns out that the law was written so flexibly that it, over the course of time, states really figured out that it was just a flexible funding stream. You could provide cash aid to families. And if you did that as a state, you had to do a ton of reporting to the federal government. There were tons of rules. You could get in trouble if you weren't following the rules. It's very complicated. Or there were these other purposes listed in the law, too, like promoting marriage or reducing out-of-marriage births. And if you said you were using the money for that, then there is no reporting or no accountability whatsoever. Mm. And what states figured out is that they could shift the money to other things and make the argument that it was promoting one of these purposes. And then they could take the money that they were spending on those other things and use it for anything they wanted. And so over
like
the
essentially
years—
Essentially a displacement in the budget.
Yes, yeah. Yeah. You know, we might think of it as a shell game.
Again, your language, not mine.
And so states have, over the course of time, just really, really reduced the use of this money for cash for families.
For what it was intended for.
Yeah,
right?
And use it for all sorts of things. Foster care is really expensive, and so a lot of states just shifted this money there because it's taking care of children. And out of the actually helping families, you know, with cash to prevent it, We've seen things like paying for like Christian summer camps in different states, and we've seen actually a really severe example of fraud where in the state of Mississippi,
sure.
$80 million plus was used for totally fraudulent purposes, giving money to celebrities and what have you. So the thing with that, of course, is that this is not what it was ever intended with this program. And I think most people would say, yeah, this isn't, wherever you're on the spectrum, sort of having a program that's not doing at all what it was ever intended is not the right way to do this. But we really don't want to go back to that old welfare system, mm-hmm. you know, that was hugely stigmatizing and punished families in so many ways and was hard and the dollar amounts were extremely low. It had these benefits cliffs in it. And so I think what Rx Kids did and why it's attracting attention all over the country, we're hearing from blue states and we're hearing from a lot of red states that are looking at it very closely for a lot of reasons that we could talk about. Because it's a very different model of providing support to families. It's focused on that first year of life where I think there's just widespread agreement, like that first year is really hard really expensive. And it doesn't have the stigma attached to the old program. And so I think I've been a part of trying to provide cash to families to help them, deal with financial crisis and get out of poverty or what have you for a long time. And something about the way that this reimagines the social contract has captivated people's attention like no other type of initiative that I've worked on before.
Yeah, yeah. So the TANF funds that the governor's moving, I mean, that's a huge shift in the way that they're thinking about those funds and thinking about programs like this. But overall, it raises the specter of sustainability, right? This is a great idea, and it's going to do all of these things in the short term, and you've raised a lot of money for it. But you have to keep raising the money, right?
I mean, that's why using the TANF dollars for this is such a game changer, because we've identified a sustainable funding stream.
Right.
So this
that
is
comes
something—
every year.
Right. So, you know, so many of these pilots, we see this a lot with different cash pilots around the country or philanthropy or American Rescue Plan dollars, and there's no path to sustainability. Mm-hmm. This TANF path, where there's widespread agreement the dollars are not being used the way they should, they're not being used really to support families. A lot of states actually have huge surpluses of these dollars. They're just sitting on a lot of dollars. It's an annual block grant. It's actually a funding stream that could support a program like this. And
entirely for every baby in Michigan,
right.
Could be supported.
There's enough money
and much left over.
Yeah. So I also want to talk about outcomes and how we measure those outcomes, right? I completely get the idea of disrupting the cycle at the beginning. Stop it from even taking root in someone's life in the first year of life. But how do we know 5 years later or 10 years later that this made a difference? What are some of the things, Mona, that you would expect to see in your work that would prove this is working?
Yeah. So, I mean, Luke and I are both academics at heart. So there is a robust kind of research arm to this work.
Yeah.
The beauty of ARCS Kids is not like it's not a sample size of 100 or 50 or 300. It is the entire population. So we can really lean on some high quality, robust administrative population level data to see the impact of this. And we can compare how Flint families are doing to families across the state. So we have a control population that we can look at. We're looking at things like, you know, healthcare utilization. Does this move the needle on prenatal visits? Do folks come in earlier? Do they come in more often? Do we diagnose gestational diabetes and preeclampsia early? Do we impact maternal morbidity and mortality and infant mortality and breastfeeding and low birth weight, NICU admissions, well child visits, immunizations? There's a whole slew of things that we can garner from this population level data to see the impact of Rx Kids and how it compares to other communities. We also have access through one of Luke's colleagues at State Welfare Data. child welfare data, so we can see the impact that this has on claims and foster care placement and reunification, and comparing that to other communities in the state as well. We're also going to be doing a survey to participants, a research survey, to get at some of things like, you know, does this, you know, rebuild your trust and faith in government and institutions? Mm-hmm. How is this impacting your stress? Are you happier? Do you have hope for you and your child? So some of the more subjective things we'll be asking through kind of research surveys. So there's a lot of research where we hope to kind of look at the outcomes. And a lot of this research is already out there. Yeah. So that, you know, we don't have to reprove for the millionth time that, you know, people are in poverty because they don't have money, and that when you give them money, you know, you know, all these wonderful things happen afterwards.
Yeah. So you and I have talked before about not stigmatizing children in Flint over the last decade because of what happened in the water crisis, right? Responding to the needs that they have, but not kind of categorizing them as damaged in some way. I do wonder, though, going forward, do you feel like the outcomes for academic outcomes or involvement with the criminal justice system, some of the negative outcomes that we do see pretty prevalently in Flint go down? Because is that a measure that you want to use to determine whether this is working?
You know, I hope so. There's a lot of long-term outcomes that we can look at. I mean, I think Luke has this great quote or great statistic, like a $1,000 investment in your first year of life, you know, reaps benefit in your 30s, like increased economic productivity. We would love to continue to follow the children and families. We'll do modeling and work with like economists and all these other folks. But, you know, the science is clear. When we invest in early childhood, it does impact the entire life course. And we hope to see those outcomes.
One of the things that's different from this project from things that I have done in the past as a social scientist is, as social scientists, we often try to zero in on like one thing and see does that one thing impact. And we've got the one big thing we've been talking about. But we're also thinking about this in terms of collective impact. And one of the most exciting things has been how so many players in the Flint community are coming alongside and saying, what else can we do for families in the first year of life? How can we do things? And it's taking kind of an organized chaos approach or a collective chaos where we don't need to plan everything, obviously, but coming alongside and saying, you know, one of our biggest goals is going to be a good start in life, right? And really turning Flint into a model for the nation, right? Flint has sort of staked ground as saying, we're going to care for our kids in this way, in a way that you don't get anywhere else in the country. And we're going to challenge the rest of the nation to come up to our level is an exciting piece of the narrative change as well.
The growth is, I think, one of the things that kind of hangs above you in a question mark form as well. Like, can you make this possible in Detroit? Can you make this possible in the whole state of Michigan? And then what other things can you add to it, right? It's not just the lack of cash that keeps people in poverty. There are all kinds of other things. And I wonder how much you've thought about what the path looks like there.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think, you know, before we even launched RX Kids in Flint, we have been thinking about how to do this, not just across the state, but really across the nation.
Across the country.
Yeah. You know,
across the world.
Across the world.
For real. We've been talking about, you know, global infant poverty.
Yeah.
I think one of the reasons that we were included in the state budget last year was as a test, like figure this out, do this so that we can quickly do this across the state.
Yeah.
We were so excited to see that in the governor's budget that was just released, you know, a few days ago in her executive budget, it included $24 million as another TANF kind of redirection to do prenatal and infant supports, you know, in in other communities.
Right.
So that is amazing. That is about 10,000 more children in the state that will be able to benefit from the program that we started in Flint.
Yeah.
So we are, you know, we are ready to do this all over. You know, tomorrow is Valentine's Day, and you know, we just learned that we spend as a nation $26 billion on Valentine's
Day.
Said
that before we started recording. I was like,
$26 billion.
It's a lot of chocolate.
Flowers and date nights and jewelry, like $26 billion we spend on Valentine's Day. This kind of the show of love to, you know, to whomever. And for that exact amount of money, we could do this for the entire nation.
We could make sure every pregnant mother had this.
What a way to show love.
What if we directed that love to, you know, collectively to our babies. So, and that's pennies in the kind of the national budget.
Of course.
We can do this as a nation, and we've garnered lots of excitement from the White House and from our congressional leaders.
Wow. Wow. All right. Well, we look forward to seeing how this all, of course, plays out. And I'm going to make you both promise you'll continue to come back and talk to us.
We love talking to you, Steve.
Anytime.
Yeah.
No, it's great to have both of you here. And congratulations on the work and the support for
Thank you.
That's going to do it for this episode of Created Equal. You can listen to recent episodes online at WDET.org and make sure you subscribe to our podcast. Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and David Lines. Additional production support comes from Jack Philbrant. Audio editing is by Connor Anderson, and the music for Created Equal is by Sam Bobian. Our program director is Adam Fox. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.